What's up, baseball fans? Welcome to the On the Bump podcast. Today we got a fun one. We got Trevor Bauer on the pod to talk about Tim Lincecum. They definitely comp for a few reasons, which we'll definitely get into with Trevor. So much so that on the draft day, many people actually called Bauer the Tim Lincecum Jr., which is pretty funny. But a little background on Trevor real quick. Third overall pick out of UCLA 2011. He was an all-star in 2018. He's pitched for the Indians for a long time, the Reds during the shortened 2020 season. Looking like the front runner for the NL Cy Young this season. Off the field, he's a big advocate for players, building their brands. He's got a media company named Momentum, which does some really cool stuff on YouTube. He'll vlog starts in the big league stuff that you just don't see from modern baseball players, which is really cool. He's definitely one of the more entertaining and outspoken ball players we have. He was also kind of a trailblazer. He was talking about pitch design and tunneling and all sorts of stuff years ago before Driveline and everyone else made it popular. So he really is a brilliant mind and someone that I'm looking forward to talking to on the podcast today. But before that, you know, I got to bore you guys with a little bit of background on big-time Timmy Jim, Tim Lincecum. So he grew up near Seattle, standout athlete as a kid, but really small stature. He's 4'11", 85 pounds as a freshman, pretty small guy, 5'8", 130 pounds as a senior. At least that's the intel I got. So, you know, you guys, I assume you know who Tim Lincecum is. If you're listening to this podcast, you can think of the crazy, unorthodox mechanics that he had. And the reason he pitched that way is him, his dad, his two brothers came together, and I guess they're all kind of similar stature. And they said, look, we're not big, we're not bulky, we're not going to get power from our size. How are we going to create velocity and create torque with, I mean, gosh, I'm 130 pounds. And that's how they came up with that, those mechanics, kind of trying to get elasticity. And as you can see, when he pitches, he gets it. And we'll get into those mechanics with Trevor Bauer, that's for sure. So Tim Lincecum commits to play at the University of Washington. Get this, with the caveat that the pitching coach is not allowed to touch his mechanics. That's pretty funny. And to think of an 18-year-old kid saying, like, yeah, I'll come pitch there, but you're not allowed to work with me. That actually ended up working great for the University of Washington baseball program, because all Tim did was Pac-10 Pitcher of the Year as a freshman and the Golden Spikes winner as a junior, which is the basically college baseball MVP. Went 12-4 with under a 2 ERA. What's funny is Trevor was also the Golden Spikes winner just a few years later, 2011 at UCLA. So Tim goes on to get drafted 10th overall in 06, debuts less than a year later, May of 07, after just dominating the minor leagues. His rookie year's good, not great, really struggles with command, has a 4 ERA, throws 100 miles an hour. But then he goes on to win a Cy Young in his second and third season. So most pitchers go to have a sophomore slump. Tim Lincecum had a sophomore Cy Young. So jumping into these Cy Young seasons a little bit, 2.62 ERA in 2008, went 18-5, led the major leagues in strikeouts, least amount of home runs given up, least amount of hits given up per nine innings. 2009, another Cy Young year, 15-7, 2.48 ERA, threw 225 innings both years. Basically kept the ball in the yard, struck everyone out. Went on to win two Cy Youngs. So, but then after that, it, I don't want to say falls apart, that's not the right term, but he goes on a struggle. I mean, you would think this is the start to a great pitching career, you know, maybe one of the better pitching careers we've ever seen. I mean, he won two Cy Youngs in his first 3 years. Well, after that, he struggles. 2010 to 2016, he's part of three World Series teams there with the Giants, but he never has an ERA below 4. One of those postseason runs, he gets moved to the bullpen and actually does really great for the Giants in the bullpen, but he just doesn't have the same kind of success after those first few dominant years for the rest of his career. And we're definitely going to dive in with Trevor as to why that might be and get his opinion. So his last couple years overall, 41-48 record, a 4.94 ERA. Like I said, never had a sub 4. Still striking people out, but his walks went up. He started giving up more homers and just kind of all his stats went in the wrong direction. So, you know, we definitely want to dive into why was he so good and still at a young age in his, you know, mid to upper 20s. And starting to struggle. So famously tries to make a comeback a few years later that falls a little bit short. So is actually his big league career would be over at 32 years old. So probably considered a little bit of a flash in a pan compared to what many would have guessed for his career trajectory. Not a Hall of Famer like we usually talk about on this podcast, but Tim Lincecum was about as dominant as any pitcher we've ever had for a 3 or 4 season span. And one of the most fun, unique, and exciting pitchers that we've ever seen grace a mound in a big league stadium and worth talking about. And with that, that's where we want to bring in Trevor Bauer. All right, what's up, guys? Welcome back to the show, and we are joined by Trevor Bauer. Trevor, what's up, man?
Just hanging out, doing off-season things.
Yeah. We're going to be talking Tim Lincecum today, as you guys know, a guy that you've been compared to many times. Not much as of late, but I'm sure early in your career, you got it all the time. What's cool about Tim compared to most of the guys we do on this podcast is you and I are old enough that we got to really watch Tim pitch. Like, I have a very firm memory of what Tim Lincecum, what his stuff was like, what his mechanics were like, what he looked like on the mound versus like a Sandy Koufax that we did with Kirsch. You know, that's just 1950s video. What's first thing that pops in your head when you think Tim Lincecum?
There's a video of him in college. It's a Friday night video at Washington against UCLA, and it's shot from the third base angle, and I have it like burned in my memory. I can close my eyes and see it like perfectly because I've watched it so many times. And the first base coach at UCLA is just standing in the background with his arms crossed, looking miserable. I played with one person at UCLA who was on that team, who was at that game. He punched out 18 in nine innings that game and gave up two hits, both infield singles. It was 40 degrees. He was sitting 99 in the ninth inning. Just an absurd story that you would never believe if you didn't know that it was real, if there wasn't video evidence. And so whenever I think of Tim, that's the first thing I think of.
It's funny to think of you and him in college. I mean, both you guys were Golden Spikes Awards winner. Like, the junior year, by the time you're kind of polished and really know what you're doing, it's borderline unfair, right? And we're going to get into a couple ways you guys compare. And one of the biggest ones is kind of the rise from college talent to professional player really quickly. I mean, you guys both spent right around a year or less in the minor leagues, and you kind of had these reputations preceding you for what you look like when you pitch, and also like the reputations off the mound and kind of being pioneers in the way that you do mechanics, the way you throw, the way you think about pitching. What was it like for you to have a reputation that kind of preceded you? I mean, I remember, you can even YouTube it. I've seen a start in, I think it was like 2012 or 13 spring training for you, and you're doing your big warm-up, and there's hundreds and hundreds of people watching you. And really, not that many people know who you are, but they hear about this pregame routine that Trevor Bauer has, and we want to go check it out. Like, what was it like kind of having a reputation preceding you before you really even stepped on the big stage in professional baseball?
I guess, so I didn't know anything else necessarily, because when I came into pro ball, that's how it was. I had people asking to do interviews. I had people, you know, following me with a camera. I didn't know that it was any different. I just assumed it was like that for everybody, because, you know, as an amateur, you look up and you're like, oh, these big leaguers, they're superstars. It's almost like they take on an alien type of feel to them, because it's not realistic in your life at that point. So you have all these thoughts in your head about like what they're like and what life is like, because you don't know. And so it wasn't until after my first spring training that I really figured out like, oh, it's not like that for everybody. And that was odd. But I didn't know any different at the time. And unfortunately for me, I guess that reputation got perceived a certain way. And so the fact that it preceded me actually caused a lot of, I guess, problems for me in the clubhouse with the organization. So much so that I was only with the Diamondbacks, who took me third overall, for about a year before I was traded. I guess technically time that I was with them was about 18 months. It was only one season. A lot of that was because the reputation for being, I guess, hard-headed or uncoachable or something like that was what lodged in people's brains before they ever met me.
Well, you guys know what makes you good, and you know why you can go out on the mound and have success, and it's kind of in your own unique way. I said it earlier in the intro, Tim Lincecum agreed to go to University of Washington as long as the pitching coach there agreed not to mess with him, saying, don't mess with my mechanics. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to pitch the way that I pitch, these unorthodox, very elastic, creating energy in a different kind of new way, and I'm not going to let you mess with me. Was it like that at UCLA for you, or were you kind of like, no, I'll take some opinions, but at the end of the day, I'm going to do what I know?
No, it was almost exactly the same for me at UCLA. I had that exact conversation with Coach Savage. I said, hey, if I come here, you're not going to mess with my workout routine and my delivery. And he said, that's fine. We'll start off that way. If you pitch well and you prove that it works at this level, I'm fine with it. Because ultimately, all I care about is, not all I care about, but what I care about most is that you're effective on the field. And I said, okay. And, you know, that was kind of the start of, you know, me betting on myself and proving everything with my performance, as I would have to do with the new age training stuff basically my entire career up until this point. I'm always open to hearing people's thoughts. But if you're going to give me a thought, or something that can help me get better or that you want me to do, you're going to have to be able to explain it very clearly and very well on exactly how it's going to help me, because I've thought through everything I do in a very deep way, and I'm not going to just take an answer that you can't explain and implement it because I feel like I have a better answer or a better understanding or better research base. I had that exact same conversation. But I think where Tim and I ended up differing is that he was almost like that way to a fault, in which he never researched for himself or found a way to adapt with how his body changed and how the league changed and stuff like that. Whereas I've based my entire career on like finding the best information available from wherever the source is. I don't need to be right or anything on all of it. I just want to find what is right at that current time.
I found a specific video. It's you and Sham and I. You guys are sitting, eating dinner together. I think it's maybe one of the original Bauer Bites from Momentum. You guys need to check those out for sure. And in the video, you basically say that you tried to copy Tim Lincecum as a young pitcher as far as mechanics. You get into it on the video a little bit, but we'll obviously talk about it a little bit here too. Did you just like the way that it looked? Or you could see, like, just by watching, you're like, all right, he's creating so much power. I want to do what he's doing because I think that I can do that as well. Or did you just be like, hey, that looks cool, I want to try it, ended up liking it?
Well, when Tim came up, I didn't know what I was watching. He's 5'8", 170 pounds, 180 pounds. And like, he's a small guy. And in college, I was 6 feet tall and 165 to 175 pounds. When I saw him up in the big leagues, just punching out the entire league, and every game he pitches, 13 strikeouts, 14 strikeouts. If you ever only struck out 8, going on MLB.com and watching the highlights, it was like, oh, well, that was boring. It was a short montage. There's not enough. What happened? And so I just looked at that and I said, that's what I have to be. Like, if I'm, as an undersized righty, going to go be a big leaguer, like, I gotta be that. And so I just tried to be that in any way that I could. And back then, you had the highlights on MLB.com sometimes, and you had whatever videos you could scrounge up online from Scouting Bureau, from just people in the stands with their phones. And I found that college video of him, you know, up at Washington pitching against UCLA. And so I said, well, this is how he does it. That's how he moves. That's how he produces that kind of velocity and all that. That's what I have to do. So I went about copying it.
So knowing what you already touched on it, you're a guy that seeks information. You want to understand. It may not be for you, but you want to understand it and learn about it. And as a guy that knows what you know now about biomechanics, the way the body moves and deliveries and just mechanics in general, like, what really sticks out to you about his delivery from, you know, now almost a decade ago? Like, would you teach, sitting in Seattle with the driveline guy, would you teach a Tim Lincecum delivery to a kid?
How much time do you have? How deep do you want me to go here? Yeah,
give me the spark notes.
I think there's a lot of things that Tim did extremely well. Momentum, first off, energy transfer, elasticity. I think that he applied those concepts very, very well. And it's good for a short period of time. Unfortunately, there's some things that he did in his delivery that weren't good for a short period or for a long period of time. Elasticity, momentum, energy transfer, all that stuff is good forever. That's how humans should move. There's some things in his delivery that he did wrong that were only good for a short period of time. I think a lot about the head tilt, about the posture tilt. You know, he threw from way up over the top, which means he had to, you know, I guess, round his spine off towards first base and kind of side bend in a way. That kills your ability to create rotational shoulder, hip, and separation. So it puts a lot more stress on the body in general, being able to kind of muscle your way through it and being young and athletic and being able to move that way. So that was one of the biggest things. I think he overstrode a little bit. Now, part of that was building the momentum into foot plant, but I think there's a more efficient way to get that same result while not putting all that stress on your hip socket and eventually, you know, your lower back. And so when you combine the stride with the hips, the hip problems, and then the back problems, that's your engine, you know, and it sends everything up the chain ultimately to your arm. Now, he never had arm problems, but he did have hip problems, he did have back problems. And so that's one thing that I noticed very quickly, probably 3 or 4 years of copying his delivery. It's like, I'm not going to be able to make it 20, 25 years doing this. I have to find a better way biomechanically for me to move because I have limitations in my hips. I have limitations in my back, stuff like that. And that's what I mentioned earlier about kind of adapting to the best information of the time and finding what's right for the current time instead of what, you know, what you think.
It's kind of like trying to find the balance between I have this unique, unorthodox delivery that probably makes me deceptive. And yeah, my stuff's really good, but I'm coming at you in this way that you don't see every day. And that makes it hard to pick up for a hitter. And maybe one of the reason he didn't adapt is you get worried that, okay, I'm just going to turn into Joe Blow righty. Maybe this is what makes me special. And yeah, you know, guys like him and you are very, I don't want to say stubborn, but you know what makes you good and you're going to stick to it. And the idea that if I change it, all of a sudden now I'm a 5'8 righty like we talked about, how am I going to get anyone out? And we'll get into it in a minute, but I mean, dude, he was really good for 3 or 4 years and then was really average for another 7. And then he was out of baseball. Like, it happened really fast.
It was the most fun to watch for that span of a couple years because there's this weird tiny guy that's on the mound that's throwing 100, that's just punching out the world and making big league hitters look stupid. And you're like, I don't know what I'm watching right now, but it's fun as hell. I'm enjoying it. But I think that, you know, you reference turning into that kind of average 5'8 righty. And I think that's really where I benefited so much is understanding what makes me good in a new age scientific truth type of way. And, you know, I came up in the big leagues right about the time that, you know, we were able to measure kind of what pitches were doing. You know, we had PitchFX that came along, and then we went to TrackMan, and now we're on Hawkeye. So we can get some objective truth on what the ball is doing in the air and what actually makes a pitcher good or not. We have some biomechanics research that's come out. You know, Driveline's kind of pioneered a lot of that. I started with a company called Biokinetics 3D in 2011 that has worked with Maddox and Nolan Ryan and a bunch of guys for 30 years doing biomechanics. So I had some objective truth there, but that stuff's only started to be popularized. I think guys that came, that played before maybe 2013 or 14 didn't have access to a lot of that data to really help shape their decisions. So when they think about what makes them good, it's like, oh, well, I've always done this and I got to the big leagues, so that must be what makes me good, when really it could have been something completely different. You know, it could have been the deception, but maybe it's just how the ball spun out of their hand and they could have changed their delivery and maintained the spin and been healthier and had more longevity and still maintained their effectiveness.
When you have the ability to buy into it and not get lost in it, right? Like, I've seen guys, they'll throw a bullpen and after every pitch, they'll turn around and be like, all right, what was that one? What was the spin? What was the vertical ride? Well, all that stuff. And all of a sudden it takes you an hour to throw a 25-pitch bullpen. And then they go stare it at an iPad for another 20 minutes and they get lost. You know, you have an ability to try something new and either take it or leave it. But you're going to understand it and either apply it or not. I want to get into the pitch mix a little bit. Like, we can talk mechanics all day. You can be as unique and powerful as you want. But at the end of the day, to get guys out in the big leagues, you got to mix speeds and throw the ball over the plate, right? So Lincecum, when I think of Lincecum, I think of the splitter. You know, definitely was a fastball, curveball, splitter guy. He would mix in some four seams, two seams, even some sliders a little bit. But, you know, to me, watching him, his stuff was electric. Like, what do you remember from his pitch mix?
Yeah, I mean, it was the 98, 99, 100. Because at that time, no one did that. He was one of the very few people that was throwing upper 90s or 100, and he was so small. So I think of the electric fastball that very clearly now, looking back on it, was a high rise type of pitch. Because it would just like take off out of his hand. It just had this different feel to it. People couldn't hit it, missed a lot of barrels. And then I think of the split. I mean, how can you not think of that split change? Just bouncing 3 feet in front of the plate and guys are wailing at it and nowhere close. And it wasn't a fluke thing. It happened 3 or 4 times every single game. It was kind of that free swing and miss pitch. I used to talk to Danny Salazar in Cleveland and he threw a split change that was like that. And that's what I called it. I called it the free swing and miss pitch. But that's what it was. So it's really that combination. Although I know when he came up in the big leagues, he was primarily fastball, curveball. And in college, he had a huge top-to-bottom 12-6 curveball that no one could touch. But really, he morphed very quickly into being a fastball split change type of pitcher.
So you and another guy we've had on this podcast, Buehler, we talked about Pedro Martinez with Buehler. You and Walker both do not throw really any changeups whatsoever. Is that just a pitch? Have you tried to add that to the arsenal and it's just not for you? Or like a curse, like I play catch with Kershaw all the time. He'll throw 5 of them in catch play. Like, he works on it. It's just not meant to be for him. Is that kind of how it is for you with the changeup splitter spin?
Yeah, I think that I'm very good at supinating And that's why I spin the ball well. That's why I can throw cutters, sliders, gyro sliders, sweeping sliders, curve balls, everything on the supination side of it. I just have very limited internal rotation in my shoulder. And so I don't think I can get to the inside of the ball very effectively. I've never been able to do it. Even when I was over the top, when I was throwing dead over the top, I couldn't side spin a ball. And throwing more three quarters now, I still can't side spin a ball. I try. I logic my way through it and say, well, maybe I can kill spin. Maybe if I hold it like this, maybe if I try that grip, but I just never been able to pick up something that's objectively good. And I don't like adding something to my arsenal that's not objectively good. So it's been a major bee in my bonnet watching guys like Luis Castillo and Danny Salazar and Carlos Carrasco and, you know, Tim for the longest time throw this split change that no one can hit. I'm like, I need that pitch, but I can't do it.
All right. So let's say you're Tim Lincecum. You were just a Cincinnati Red this year, so let's put you in the NL Central, and you got Christian Yelich in the box, former MVP, and you got Lincecum's arsenal. What do you think your pitch sequence is to a Christian Yelich?
Probably fastballs to the hands. I think you have to go up in there to kind of speed him up, and then it's that down and away corner. It's the fastball freeze down and away with the split below the zone. You know, Tim elevated the fastball quite a bit, and he didn't throw his curveball a whole lot. Probably that, working that down and away corner. Not a whole lot of strikes, though. I think you can get Yelich to swing on that split change below the zone quite a bit. As long as you elevate a fastball every now and then to keep him honest.
We touched on a little bit earlier is just kind of how fast it changed for Tim. I mean, I wrote it down. In 2011, he had a 2.7 through 215 innings, was in the Cy Young hunt. And then 2012, he had a 5-plus ERA and led the league in losses with 15. So it happened really fast, and we've already kind of gone down this alley a little bit, but you know, to be that dominant and then to basically almost instantly start almost having zero success in the big leagues, yet to be durable. I mean, he still made 32-plus starts for 5 or 6 seasons with never being below a 4 ERA. Why do you think he started to struggle so quickly? Like, there wasn't just like a 2-season kind of, all right, I'm dwindling down. I mean, it happened overnight, basically over an offseason to him. Like, what do you attest that to?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple different things. One, as your body starts to change, as you lose a little bit of that youthful athleticism and the recovery, really, that goes with being younger, you can't bounce back from inefficiencies in your delivery nearly as quick. So you probably end up with some nagging stuff. Potentially, I have no idea, but potentially had some injuries over the offseason that just never really kind of healed or never really got addressed. And then you roll into the next season, you're a little bit behind the eight ball, you don't recover quite as well as you're used to. The work ethic may need to be different. You may need to work on different things at that point in your career. So if you don't adjust with that, then you roll into a season behind. And then if your velocity drops a little bit, now the pitch mix isn't quite as special. You can't command the ball, so you walk a lot of people. Then when you do have to throw strikes, you give up some hits and some bad times. And so it can happen very quickly. I mean, it happened to me last year. My stuff was almost identical movement-wise and all that to 2018 when I had a 2.1 or 2.2 ERA. And I finished last year, the last 2 months, I had a 6.5. I wasn't really materially a different pitcher. I was just behind the count a lot. My fastball velo dropped 1 mile an hour. I didn't recover nearly as well because I had some nagging stuff going on, and it can happen very quickly. Then you add in on top of that, you know, the psychological side of things, going through that for an entire season after coming off of being elite and probably never having struggled in his entire life before. I mean, I got to imagine, even in high school, I'm sure he was just one of the best guys from the stories that I hear from people that saw him in high school. That seems to be true. So there's probably quite a few things there that contribute to it. My guess would be the physical side of things. I think there's probably something nagging, whether it was his hip or his back. It's probably the start of the downfall.
Well, the off seasons are huge, right? Like, I remember you have either posted some stuff on Momentum or just from talking to you a little bit, like you'll pick one or two really big topics in an off season and try and tackle it. I think last year was spin. I mean, weren't you throwing some fastballs in like 3,000 plus spin this year? I think, You obviously are always focused on the way your body's moving and your mechanics. I think command has been a big one that you've worked on too. Like, maybe Tim just didn't have the wherewithal or the work ethic to, you know, when you like you kind of touched on, you roll out of bed since you're 16 years old and you're the best on the field to all of a sudden now I got to spend my winter months getting better. You know, not everyone wants to do that.
Not everyone wants to do it. Not everyone has the tools to be able to do it. And a lot of people work very hard, but they direct their work in the wrong areas. You work very hard at one thing and you make a lot of gains in it, but the more gains you make, the harder it is to make further gains, right? It's the law of diminishing return. But if you don't ever switch to working on something else, like you end up working very hard for very, very little gain while the other areas of your game slip. And I think that's really where new age technology and data like helps and is such a powerful tool, because it can pinpoint at any given time, like, okay, this is where you're good and this is where you need work. And that changes. I mean, that changes month to month, start to start, year to year. Sometimes you need to work on your command. Sometimes you might need a new pitch. Sometimes you need to sharpen up a pitch that you've thrown for 10, 15 years. When I changed my delivery, I went from having an elite curveball that I always went to in a bad situation to having a very bad curveball for a period of time. And it's like, well, if I never realized that my curveball was bad at that time, I never would have known to try to sharpen it up and to work on it. And so I would have kept going to it in situations where it's just not the right pitch because it's not a good pitch anymore. But in my head, it's still a good pitch. And so having that new age technology and the evaluation, the understanding of what actually makes you good is so helpful and can be such a powerful guiding tool.
So Tim famously basically tries to make a comeback in 2017, I believe, goes to Driveline. Were you there at all in Seattle with him during that time?
Yeah, I don't know if I... The first time I met Tim Lincecum, he's laying on a training table. I've imagined this in my head, you know, this meeting of Tim Lincecum for years and years, because it's like you look up to the guy, right? He's laying on a training table getting worked on. I walk in and Sam, the guy working on him, goes, "Oh, hey, Trevor, this is Tim. Tim, this is Trevor," makes the introduction. And Tim, the first thing out of his mouth is like, "Hey, who's got the biggest piece in the big leagues?" I'm like, I did not in a million years think that this was going to be the way my first interaction with Tim Lincecum went, but here we are. So yeah, I was there for that. That was quite the off season.
That's funny. So obviously he's there just trying to make a comeback in general. You're a guy that is adamant about maintaining or even gaining velocity as you go through your career, and you even have. Tim, he was averaging 95 miles an hour as a rookie in 07. Got all the way down to averaging 88 in 2015. He was only 30 years old at the time. I'm going to be 31 going into the season. That doesn't make me feel very good about where I'm at. You know, you touched on the possibility of nagging injuries and all that kind of stuff. I mean, averaging 88 in the big leagues, even in 2015, it's tough to get it done. Do you think that being around him at Driveline, was he trying to get velocity back? Did that seem to be the big kind of like the big focus while he was up there?
Yeah, no doubt. I think that's the most obvious thing, right? Is like you can see the radar gun and it's, oh, he just doesn't have it anymore. But like you said, he was only 30. And if you look at the prime of athletic careers, just the human body in general, you usually hit your athletic prime 27 to 32, 28 to 33, somewhere in that range, maybe a little bit earlier for some people, 25 to 30. Either way, it's not like he was way past his physical prime. So brings into question the work ethic. Are you directing your work in the right ways? How's your body recovering? Are your mechanics just not set up to be able to maintain elite velocity over the long haul? So he was definitely out there trying to work on his velocity to get back. And he actually did. I mean, in one of his exit bullpens, he was 92 to 94 in his bullpen. And then I know he went to spring training. I don't know exactly. He had a groin or something like that that happened, I think, in spring training and just never... It never materialized for him. Yeah, I think velocity is the biggest thing. Definitely was when he was up there working. And he actually did, you know, gain some of that velocity back.
So let's say it's 2011 now. You know, he's a few years past his Cy Youngs, and he's starting to diminish a little bit. He's starting to struggle. And you're his teammate. Let's say you're even his veteran teammate. And you know what you know. You're Trevor Bauer. You know what you know about mechanics, the way the body moves, all that stuff, and Tim Lincecum is willing to work, willing to change. What's, you know, this next bullpen session, what are you sitting down with Tim and saying like, hey, let's work on this, you know, let's change this and see what happens? Is there like some glaring thing to you when you watch him pitch now saying like, man, if we could have gotten him away from that, he might have had five more years of crazy success like he was going?
Yeah, it's the posture tilt. It's that side bend in the spine. And really what that is linked to is the hips. You know, he has this very long stride, this almost explosive jump off the mound, in which the back leg extends early. Anytime you extend the back leg early, really before your foot hits the ground, or your front foot hits the ground, then you lock out your hip rotation. It stops it due to human anatomy. So that's where I would have started. You're like, hey, let's get rid of this like jump off the mound. Let's actually rotate your hips so that right hip of his, instead of elevating and pushing would have kind of sunk down a little bit more and rotated, which would have given him a really stable base on the lower half once his front foot hit to be able to rotate around. And then that would have allowed the creation of some rotational shoulder hip separation as opposed to just basically side bending and using the entire upper body to throw with. And really that's where I feel like his main issues stem from. It's kind of exploding too early in the delivery and not really generating rotational shoulder hip separation. He was very elite at linear shoulder hip separation, but it's also one of the reasons that he struggled commanding the ball is this big side tilt. His head was moving a lot, his eyes were moving a lot, and so he was constantly struggling to have that type of command. That's where I would have started. I'd teach him how to rotate his hips instead of extending his hips.
Yeah, it's fun talking to someone that really understands the way the body moves, you know, has bought into the new era of information and totally understanding it. You know, we did Sandy Koufax with Clayton Kershaw, and the thought was, okay, how could have Sandy been better, younger, because he really struggled when he was early, and he was like, oh, just throw more strikes, you know? And then I ask you the same question, and you give me a 10-minute anatomy lesson. It's just, you know, the amount of information and the guys that are buying into it in baseball now, I think, is great. You know, we got into it a little bit with Pedro Martinez and Buehler, and, you know, the driveline effect, I don't know if that's what you would call it, but I kind of call it on pitching, I think has been great because I think more and more guys are just learning more and more information and being able to use it on the mound to get better. That's why we're seeing some unbelievable products on the mound and guys have unbelievable stuff because, I mean, you can work on it year round like you do and it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, the rate at which pitching skill has advanced has been mind-blowing in really the last 3 years. From the time that driveline kind of started gaining, I guess, traction in the big league level. That kind of coincided with the Astros winning the World Series before the cheating scandal was really like understood. And so the perception was, hey, analytics, like looking at information this way is important. And that really spurred the development of it. Now every team has some sort of Rapsodo or camera or something out there. They're trying to give their players more information. They're scouting, they're drafting players. So like the level of velocity in the league is crazy. Average velocities are skyrocketing. Everybody that comes out of a pen nowadays is throwing 100. I mean, you get five guys with the Rays in the World Series throwing 100, and then everyone that the Dodgers run out there, with the exception of Kenley Jansen, who's throwing nasty cutters at 94, is throwing 95 plus. Left side, right side. I mean, that was just unheard of really even 5 years ago. The rate at which the skill is advancing, the pitch design stuff, the breaking balls, like it's crazy to see unfolding. I mean, before our eyes, we're seeing guys every day in the clubhouse and in the opposing dugout that are just like, where did this guy come from?
Yeah, and you're kind of a trailblazer for it. So are you, do you feel proud or do you feel like, yeah, guys, I've been telling you this for a decade?
I definitely feel proud. I took a lot of the arrows in the back being the first one through the door, you know? But one of my main goals in my career is to leave a better landscape for players in general, from the on-field development side to the health side, representation, marketing, branding, opportunity off the field, all that. I want to see a better landscape for players when I leave the game than there was when I came into it. And so watching this happen and seeing players that traditionally may not have gotten a chance, like get some information, get better and get to play in the big leagues or extend their careers or have more success, you know, be a Cy Young candidate or whatever the case is. Like, it's a proud thing for me. There's been a lot of people that have worked very hard on it though. So I don't want to say that I'm proud of it. Like I'm taking complete credit for it. I've had a small part in it, I think.
All right, let's finish the podcast with the question we finish every episode with, and that is, how would he be now? Which is kind of a weird question to ask, because since he basically played in modern baseball, he had access to almost all of the same information. You touched on some of the new kind of analytical side of it. I'm talking more of just like scouting hitters and that kind of stuff, had the same kind of information. But, you know, let's say he's 8 years younger than he actually is, and he's a rookie in 2020. Do you think that Lincecum would be as good now as he was in 2008?
I don't think he would be quite as good because I think the level of hitting has advanced quite a bit, the understanding of hitters and breaking down scouting reports. That being said, I think the difference would be very, very small. I still think he would be an elite player in the game just looking at his arsenal. And you look around the league nowadays, the rush is to find people who throw from have that true backspin on the ball. throw from a low arm slot. Even though Tim was directly over the top, he was so far out down the mound and so low in his delivery that by the time he actually released the ball, his release point was still very low. So he has that low release point, high spin, high rise four-seamer, and then an invisible changeup. I think Masahiro Tanaka, but add 8 miles an hour to the fastball. I think, you know, Carlos Carrasco, who's 95 with that kind of split change, but a couple ticks up from that. Yeah, I think you'd be really good in today's game. The one thing that I think he would have to do to be an effective, to be as elite as he was back in his prime, would be to add a third pitch that he threw 10-15% of the time. Whether that's the curveball, probably would have been a curveball. I would say if I was going to have him add a pitch, it would be that, just to bring back the curveball that has that top to bottom depth. I'm thinking like Tyler Glasnow is a good comp for that. But you add in a Tanaka split to that repertoire. Like that's, Lincecum's split had a very similar profile to those three pitches. That's tough to deal with for a hitter.
Yeah, the splitter's kind of lost its popularity a little bit. And I feel like the guys with dominant splitters in today's game are really dominant because you just don't see split. Like we, the Dodgers have a guy named Tony Gonsolin who was a really good rookie for him in 2020, and he throws a splitter. He's kind of a unique guy, and he throws a splitter, and you just don't see it like you used to. So now, fast forward 8 years for Tim Lincecum, and he's throwing this elite splitter, and I just don't think modern hitters, 2020 hitters, see it as much as they did then, and I think he just chews them up.
Absolutely. So with that, he can work the bottom of the zone with the fastball and below the zone with the split. That's what Masahiro Tanaka does so well, and he's very effective even at 92. So, but you stack elite velocity on top of that, 98 with that split at the bottom of the zone, and then that's why I say with the curveball, you can work the top of the zone, which is kind of the rage in the big leagues right now, that high spin fastball up and the breaking ball down, and so you can tunnel that fastball and curveball at the top of the zone together. It opens up so many different options and so many different hitter types that you can attack with the same setup.
Well, gosh, man, he might have just been like 7 years before his time. I mean, he still won two Cy Youngs, so you can't dog him too much. But
and three World Series.
And three World Series, you're absolutely right. Trevor, this was fun, man. You're definitely going to leave the game better than where you found it. I think we can all comfortably say that. And you're always a blast to talk to, man. Thanks for taking a little bit of time talking. Tim Lincecum, this was a ton of fun. Enjoy your offseason, man, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.